This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large. Ahead on our program tonight, Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek talks with the CDC team leader in Northwest Arkansas, working to help understand better and slow the spread of COVID-19 in the region. And later, a Monday night trip through history, courtesy of the Pryor Center. Tonight, Arkansas native and baseball Hall of Famer Brooks Robinson. Tomorrow on 1A on 91.3 KUAF, some governments are pushing for immunity passports, documents saying people have recovered from COVID-19 and can avoid restrictions. But scientists say we still don't know if recovery means anything, and will people cheat to get them? Here and now, tomorrow afternoon at 1 on 91.3. Arkansas's cumulative number of COVID-19 cases now tops 20,000. Governor Asa Hutchinson says there were 430 new cases reported in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, with the most, 92, in Washington County. Benton County recorded 48 new cases, and Sebastian County, 22. There was an additional death, bringing Arkansas's fatalities from the virus to 265. Hospitalizations now number 300. That's the highest total since the beginning of the pandemic. But the governor says there may be some good news in the numbers. The most recent one-day positive total does represent a fifth consecutive day with a statewide lower number than the previous day. There are 5,227 active community cases in the state, and that's 20 fewer than Sunday's total. Governor Hutchinson says the question is, can the state continue to have fewer cases, or will there be more fluctuations? The governor says the ability to isolate and trace positive cases in Northwest Arkansas over the past couple of weeks might be leading to a reduction of new cases.
We had a concentrated effort of testing and trying to identify those and isolate those cases. It's taken some time, but I think that strategy is working. And then secondly, it's the constant effort by our community leaders to make sure that people wear masks, they understand the importance of that, and social distancing. That all combined effort is what gives you success, and I think you can specifically look at that in some of the decline in Northwest Arkansas.
And the governor says he's not ready to discuss further easing of business opening restrictions.
We've got further ways to go, and Dr. Smith and I, as we get together every day, that's not the lead topic of our conversation. When are we going to get to lift some additional restrictions? The topic of our conversation is, how can we get these cases down? How can we do a better job of isolation and tracing? What more resources do we need? How can we encourage Arkansans to do the right thing?
He says the state has conducted more than 167,000 tests in June and has raised its test per 100,000 residents rate to the third highest among states in the South. He also says the state has received more than 50,000 new N95 masks for healthcare workers. The governor made his comments at this afternoon's press briefing in Little Rock. The entire briefing can be viewed at the governor's YouTube channel. You can also learn more during our morning newscast with Antoinette Grajeda at 5:30 and 7:30 every Monday through Friday. And you can follow how the virus is affecting our region at the COVID-19 update page at KUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large. A team from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will be in Northwest Arkansas through the end of this week after arriving in the region 2 weeks ago. The Arkansas Department of Health requested CDC assistance as COVID-19 cases surge in both the Latino and Marshallese communities. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with team leader Angela Hernandez over the weekend about the type of information and data they're gathering, how they're doing it, and what will happen to it once they wrap up their mission.
We've heard a lot about your work here. You've been here for 2 weeks now. Can you give us an idea of how you work, how you gather information and data in trying to help this region tackle the surge of coronavirus that we're seeing?
You know, when we are deployed, we come with specific mission and goals. And in this case, you know, we are supporting the Arkansas Department of Health in their COVID response in Northwest Arkansas. There are two counties that are the ones that have highest reports of COVID cases in the state. So our task here is very specific, developing and implementing a plan to determine drivers of transmission in the Latinx and Marshallese communities in the region. In doing that, we are assisting with processing and synthesizing epidemiologic data to assess the burden and trends of disease, and also supporting, you know, the development of the community outreach plans and nuances and specifics needs of these communities. So once we have that mission, CDC, you know, deploys a multidisciplinary team. In our case, we have behavioral scientists, we have medical epidemiologists. We're also joined by Arkansas epidemiologists. And we also have subject matter experts that support our team remotely.
And I've heard from both some Latinx and Marshallese community leaders that I've spoken with that you're meeting with them, you're doing focus groups, and you're also gathering information that way. How does that work? What are you trying to find out from the people that you're meeting here on the ground, like these community leaders?
So we look at information from different angles. You know, we look at, you know, gathering, cleaning, analyzing the epidemiologic data that's available to characterize the burden among Hispanic and Marshallese populations. We're looking at trends of cases reported, hospitalizations, deaths. We look at potential relationships to community locations, households, occupations, looking at potentially how we can explain or can discern, you know, if there's a way of looking at how transmission is spreading. We also conduct meetings, talk to community leaders, key informant groups, members of the community, members of the Arkansas Department of Health that are working directly with the community to get a better understanding of the situation and of the needs, in addition to site visits and outreach. So the data tells one story. We're looking also at how, you know, the community and complements this part of providing us with a better understanding of a situation. In doing this, we are, you know, doing focus groups with young adults, general members of the community. This information provided by the community is critical to better understand the transmission dynamics and help us develop recommendations for prevention and mitigation, messages that are tailored to the community, and also better identify the channels to disseminate this messaging. We also want to gain a good understanding and identify, you know, what are those community partners which are very strong in this area? How can we support those partnerships between professional groups, health department, community groups, community members, so that they can share information and their efforts, you know, to prevent further spread of COVID. All this information also helps to kind of better direct resources and care so that, you know, the needs of the community are addressed. So it's information from different sources that we are synthesizing and integrating to provide recommendations.
You mentioned you're using epidemiological data in your research. What does that data consist of?
So data is reported back to the Department of Health by different sources, testing information, different healthcare providers, community, contact tracing information. So all this information is reported to the health department through their surveillance means. And as you can imagine, this information is large, significant. And what we're doing is taking part of this information and looking and taking like a deeper dive into these particular communities to gain that better understanding. Data from death, data from hospitalizations, things that we're hearing in the community so that we can synthesize it.
And from my understanding, at least, and correct me if I'm wrong, originally when you were coming into this area, it was to look at the Latinx population specifically. And then I think through some meetings, there were conversations about, well, the Marshallese community is also being disproportionately affected by this. Is that kind of how these meetings came about, that the Marshallese community became a part of this conversation as well?
I believe that in looking at the information, it became clear that even though our original mission was to focus on the Latinx community, with the health department, there was a need to expand beyond the Hispanic community to include the Marshallese community as well. You know, as when we arrived and started looking at this information, determined that there was need beyond that. So that's kind of what initial assessments look like. You come in with, you know, what information you have, and then once you get here and see what's in the field, the mission can expand.
I know your mission here still isn't over, and you will be preparing a report for the state once it is, but can you give us an idea of the types of factors you're looking at as potential spreaders of this virus?
We've looked at, you know, people's occupations, you know, their households, the businesses, also looking at, you know, information that they have, resources that are available in the communities. We've talked to community providers, healthcare providers. We've also looked at health department, testing. We're still in the process of collecting and processing information. And as you can imagine, you know, the process of untangling all this information from the community, workplace, households, it's in progress. Some of the things that we can tell you are that, you know, mitigation measures are critical. Prevention measures are critical to deter the spread. Also recognizing that, you know, there are older adults and persons with medical conditions that can be at highest risk of severe illness. So when you're thinking about this, maintaining good social distance is very important in preventing this spread. You have to look at this in the context of households, of, you know, grocery stores, how people go about their everyday business and their everyday lives. You know, it represents a change in their practices. Washing your hands with soap and water, you know, cleaning and disinfecting surfaces that you touch, covering your mouth or nose, not only protecting, you know, oneself because it starts there, but with, you know, your community and other people around the community that are increased of risk. So if you take these prevention measures into the context of everyday's lives, that's what we're trying to understand as we're doing these focus groups and understanding how can, you know, we can provide recommendations that can facilitate the implementation of these.
So what have you heard from the community leaders that you've met with in these focus groups that you've held? And is there anything that you've taken note of that you've just seen out in these communities?
Well, you know, we've heard concerns from the Marshallese and from the Latinx community. We've heard that they're not always sure about what are the best practices to stop the spread. you know, doing our site visits. We were able to provide some materials, answer some of the questions. We were very happy to see that many local businesses are encouraging COVID mitigation. For example, you know, you see a business that has a handwritten posters, you know, encouraging people to wear a mask, to wash their hands. You know, it's a handwritten poster. It's not something that they got somewhere. You know, they did it on their own, and they're posting these on the door of their business. So these are signs, you know, that the community is it's engaging, is interested, and they want to protect themselves to stop the spread. So all these are encouraging signs.
And did your information gathering include speaking to any business leaders in the region, like representatives from some of these poultry plants that are seeing a lot of COVID-19 cases?
You know, our task was to focus on the community. So that's the work that we've been focusing on most.
Once you wrap up your information gathering, your data gathering, and you analyze it all, what will you provide to the state? What will be sort of all the things that you will give to the Arkansas Health Department?
So we will not only be providing the state with the results of our analysis, answers to the many questions that they had. We will be providing them with recommendations, and these recommendations may look in different forms, you know, recommendations for testing, recommendations for communication plans. So it will look, provide a comprehensive recommendations based on our findings to the health department. We're also going to meet with the communities before we return.
To wrap up this conversation, what is your message to everyone out there about this virus?
I think it is really mostly important to prevent the spread. It starts with, you know, each person, you know, maintaining good social distance, washing your hands with soap and water, cleaning and disinfecting, frequently touched surfaces, covering your mouth and nose with close face coverings when you're around others, and taking all the steps to protect yourself, your community, and others for getting COVID. Because there's the spectrum of this disease goes from asymptomatic to very severe illness to death. We have, you know, this spectrum, particularly for people that are asymptomatic, that we just don't know. So covering your face, using your masks, social distancing, washing your hands is really important. Wearing your mask, remember, protects others. Some people may think that they wear the mask to protect themselves, but the closed face is meant to protect others in case you are infected. Continue maintaining the 6 feet between yourself and others, and that the closed face cover is not a substitute for social distancing. If you feel sick or you think you've been around someone with COVID, or you have symptoms, please don't delay. Follow the steps, the recommendations provided by CDC. Go get tested and practice social distance, even within your own homes. We've never been, as a community, under, you know, changing and taking precautions as we go about our daily lives. So how do we incorporate all these measures into our daily lives? And also learning, you know, take care of yourself, the people you care about, and your community as a way to make us all stronger.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for everything you do, too. Thank you for keeping the message out.
That was Arkansas CDC team leader Angela Hernandez speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. And we did ask whether the team gets any breaks or days off while they're on their mission. And the answer is no, they don't. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Pack Rat Outdoor Center, Northwest Arkansas's outdoor outfitter since 1973. Pack Rat offers a variety of backpacks, tents, kayaks, clothes, and shoes. Information on Facebook or online at packratoc.com.
The City of Fayetteville and the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks are teaming up for the Fayetteville Cares Blood Drive tomorrow from 10 until 6. It will be held at First Baptist Church in Fayetteville. Just in the Fayetteville last year, CBCO provided more than 5,000 blood products to Fayetteville hospitals while only receiving 1,500 blood donations in the Fayetteville community. This means other communities had to step up and donate to help support hospital usage and patient needs. Blood supplies are at critically low levels because of drive cancellations during the pandemic. For more on the blood drive in Fayetteville tomorrow, cbco.org. And the deadline for small businesses to apply for a Paycheck Protection Program, or a PPP loan, is tomorrow. If you'd like to speed up the application process, the U.S. Small Business Administration has reconfigured its Lender Match online portal to help quickly connect borrowers with PPP lenders. More information available at sba.gov/paycheckprotection. And radio listeners don't live by news alone. We know that. So tonight at 8, after the updated evening edition of Ozarks, we'll have classical music until 5 tomorrow morning. You can hear Peter Van de Graaff play great music from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. every Sunday through Thursday night on KUAF. And you can hear classical music at any time on KUAF 2 on your HD radio in your car or at home at KUAF.com or by asking your smart speaker to play KUAF 2.
Artist Nicholas Smith's portrait of George Floyd wearing a tuxedo and bow tie was meant to celebrate and mourn his life.
He's questioning, why did this happen to me? I want my art to show the world, like, this is a human being that lived on this earth and should still be living on this earth.
More on the activism in Smith's paintings of Black heroes and victims of police brutality this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 3 to 6 on 91.3. Thursday evening, Arkansas Secretary of State John Thurston issued a formal opinion on absentee ballot procedures for the 2020 general election, writing that as chief election officer for Arkansas, he's been fielding questions and concerns from citizens who seek to safely vote during the pandemic. Thurston says state law allows registered voters to request absentee ballots if ill, physically disabled, serving in the military, or temporarily out of state. He also writes anyone who expects to be unavoidably absent due to a natural disaster, war, or global pandemic can legally vote in Arkansas. At his press briefing Friday, Governor Asa Hutchinson said Thurston appears to be giving voters a legal way to avoid crowded voting sites on Election Day.
It certainly seems to indicate so to me. And so Secretary Thurston, by saying, those that might be concerned about the pandemic and going to the polls, they would be unavoidably absent, and therefore they would be in compliance and would be allowed to have an absentee ballot. And so I want to have some further discussions on that, but if that is the interpretation, then that to me looks to me like that remedies the challenge that some of the voters were facing. So we'll have some more conversations, but we're hopeful that might be able to address the problem, because that's the goal in my viewpoint, is to make sure that people have an opportunity to vote and they're not prohibited from voting, or they aren't able to exercise their right to vote because of their concerns about the pandemic. We want voter integrity, but I believe our absentee law is consistent with that.
Thurston also writes voters who expect to be unavoidably absent on Election Day and for other reasons should contact their local county clerk and request an absentee ballot. Absentee ballot PDF forms are available to download on the Arkansas Secretary of State's website. Deadline for a postal mail or email ballot request is no later than October 27th. In-person absentee ballot pickup is available through November 2nd. Absentee ballot return dates for in-person delivery is Monday, November 2nd, and by mail, November 3rd. Voter registration deadline in Arkansas, Monday, October 5th. Early voting begins on October 19th. This is Ozarks at Large.
And off for Baltimore, number 5, Brooks Robinson.
If you are a baseball fan, that sound probably makes you very nostalgic for the times when we had baseball. It is a cut introducing Brooks Robinson when he was a Baltimore Oriole, and it comes to us from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, one of the digitized archives that we're going to hear today because Randy Dixon is on the phone with me from his home. Randy is with the Pryor Center. How are you doing, Randy?
Great, Kyle. How are you?
Very good. I love these segments. We get to hear digitized archives that have been provided to the Pryor Center from KATV in Little Rock, made possible through a gift from the Tyson family.
That's right, and I love doing these. It's great to research them and find all this and come on and talk with you every week.
Well, Brooks Robinson was one of the best third basemen in baseball history, a native of Central Arkansas, and at the time when he was with the Baltimore Orioles, that was one of, if not the most storied franchises at that time.
Well, and he played with them his entire 23-year major league career.
Right.
He was there from 55 to 77. And, of course, while he was there, they won two World Series.
Including the 1966 series when they swept the Los Angeles Dodgers. And we have some content from Brooks talking about that, don't we?
Well, we found footage from 1966. There was a big homecoming for him. And he came back to Arkansas after the World Series win, and he was greeted at the airport. It was a huge crowd of people that included some notables. Bud Campbell from KATV talked to him, but then also Bill Dickey and Billy Mitchell were there to greet him.
I certainly appreciate that. I tell you, a lot of nice things have happened to me, especially this year, but this is the nicest of all, coming home and being welcomed by people you've known all your life, and this is a high point in my career and a high point in my life.
Bill Dickey, a Hall of Famer, and a fellow who knows a real good baseball player when he sees one. I think, Bill, you're as proud of Brooks as everyone in Arkansas is, aren't you?
Bud, you're not kidding. Brooks, I want to say congratulations. We're all proud of you down here, and I know how you felt when you that final out of that World Series game, 4 straight.
Well, you're right, Bill. It was a great thrill, and I tell you, I was really glad to get those 4 out of the way. I didn't care about going back to Los Angeles to play anymore.
Billy Mitchell, I'm going to ask him to come in because Brooks, way back there, I know that you got part of your start anyway at the Boys Club. Bill, what capacity did Brooks figure in back in those days?
Well, he won some midget league championships for the Little Rock Boys Club, and I think played twice on the State Midget League championship team for the Boys Club.
You haven't forgotten those days either.
No, I'm afraid not, but I tell you, I remember him very vividly, and Lamar Porterfield especially.
And you heard Billy Mitchell there talking about when Brooks Robinson played in what was called the Midget League. That was the actual name of it back in the...
It's not very politically correct these days. 40s
and 50s. It was basically a little league, right?
Right, right. And they played at a field called Lamar Porter Field, and it was near downtown. And my dad, who was a few years older than him, told me years ago that he used to watch him. And he said even in Little League, he was an amazing player. He said people would flock there just to see Brooks Robinson as a kid.
Of course, when Brooksy was growing up, I mean, baseball, of course, is still big and important now. But when Brooksy was growing up, baseball was the American pastime. And he and his dad played, and they started not with a baseball, though. What? Tell me more about this.
Well, he'll explain here, but KTV talked to his dad and then his mom but they play with a tennis ball. And he explains why.
Brooks Robinson Sr. remembers how it all began. And actually, Mr. Robinson, it began with a tennis ball, I think, didn't it?
That is right, Bud. When he was a small boy, we always had a tennis ball here, and we got out in the backyard and played catch with him, you know, and we was afraid to use a regular baseball. We were afraid it might injure him, you know, and so from then on, he just went on and played wherever he could.
The day before Brooks Jr. was born, where were you?
Well, I was at a ball game watching my husband play. He's played sports all through school, and we were at a ball game that night, and I was watching him play. And the next morning, I was in the hospital and had Brooks Jr.
Not that these things can be predestined before birth, but you're watching your young husband play baseball while you're about to give birth in 24 hours to your son, who is going to become a Baseball Hall of Famer.
It was karma.
Just a side note, KATV loved talking to the parents of famous Arkansans, didn't they? We've heard from Glenn Campbell's parents, Johnny Cash's parents.
That was kind of a theme, yeah. Jim Pitcock liked to do that. He liked to, you know, make it personal. And he would usually, if he could, talk to the parents of a, I guess, celebrity, if you would call it that, whether it was in sports or entertainment. He would try to find their parents and talk to them about, you know, their childhood.
Yeah. You know, if we've talked about the 66 series, of course, the Birds, the Orioles won the 1970 series against the Cincinnati Reds as well after being upset in 1969 by the amazing Mets. But in that 1970 series, Brooks was nothing short of amazing, especially with his glove. He did swing a mean bat, and we'll talk about that in a minute, I think, but he was renowned for what he could do with his glove at third base.
Oh, gosh. You know, as a kid, I used to watch him. He was easily my favorite baseball player. But it was sort of like, you know, when he would field a ball, it was like watching Nureyev.
Or right.
Especially in the slow motion, you know, replays of him diving for a ball and then throwing it. But, yeah, I mean, his nickname was the human vacuum cleaner, which I think is a terrible nickname, personally. But Mr. Hoover.
And you've got a cut from his longtime, very famous baseball manager about him as a player.
Well, I guess his attitude and temperament are as about ideal for baseball or life in general as anybody could have in the position he's in. He loves his job. He loves to play baseball. He don't like to sit out a game. If he does have to sit out a ball game, he accepts it, and he's still part of the ball club. As far as work is concerned, as great a third baseman as he is and has been throughout the years, each night when he gets to the park and we take the field to go through our batting practice drill, he'll take his 30 or 40 ground balls and loosen himself up.
That's Earl Weaver, who sounds very calm.
Very nice, by the way, which wasn't always the case.
If you're unfamiliar with baseball lore, Earl Weaver was known as someone who would come out and yell at the umpire and kick dirt on him and turn his baseball.
Kick dirt on the shoes, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, he was pretty much a hothead, but you could tell he really felt a lot about Brooks and his character.
And Robinson, on those Orioles teams of the 60s and 70s, he was a superstar. He was beloved there, but he was not the only one. Frank Robinson, who, of course, won an MVP. You had pitchers like Jim Palmer. And speaking of slick defenders, Mark Belanger at shortstop. And then you had Boog Powell at first, this big, towering mountain of a baseball player.
Yes. And we have a little bit of an interview with him here about his, you know, even though he was known for playing third base, he was also a pretty darn good batter. He had a .267 average, almost 3,000 hits, and he had 268 home runs.
And so here's Boog Powell talking about Brooksy as a batter.
What about Brooks Robinson as a batter, Boog?
Well, I've seen Brooks now for, I guess this is my ninth full year in the big leagues, and overall I would have to say he's one of the best hitters that I've ever seen come along. especially where our ball club is concerned. He's got so many big hits for us, it'd be just about impossible to stop and count them all. And it's meant a lot to me, too, as a hitter.
Now, what you're talking about is the ability to hit in the clutch.
Well, this is true. And he proved this again. I think the last series we had against the Yankees over there at home, he hit a grand slam home run in the bottom of the ninth inning, which was a real big ball game for us. And it always seems when the big ball games are up there, Brooks is in there swinging the bat for us.
I'm talking with Randy Dixon, who is from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. We're taking another stroll down Arkansas history's streets, and we're doing this one about Brooks Robinson, the all-time great baseball player born in Arkansas. Okay, so Randy, if there's a theme that we've had with some of these of talking to parents, there's another one, and that is the Arkansan done good coming back home.
Of course, it was nice that you were selected as Arkansas's Professional Athlete of the Year for the second time, but I guess one of the real big honors this winter would have to be that Hickok Award, wouldn't it?
Well, it sure was. It was a big thrill to me, mainly because it was more or less for the Pro Athlete of the Year, you know. And
in all sports.
In all sports, yes. And it's
a beautiful belt, and it looks like it is worth $10,000. I know I'm going to have to pay taxes on that, too. But it was a great honor to receive it, and I was with some great people there, and Bobby Orr, who plays for the Boston Bruins, and also George Blanda was there, and we really had a great night. And it was terrific. I'm just very happy to receive it.
Is it some sort of a belt that you put in a trophy case? It's not the type of belt you could ever wear, is it?
No, you can wear it, yes. It's got a great big front buckle on it, then you could put it around you. But it wouldn't be, it has about 26 small diamonds and a large diamond in front with a sapphire and a ruby on each side, and a lot of it is gold, so I wouldn't be parading it around any place. I'd put it in a locked box, and that's where it is right now.
You heard him describing the belt. I want to see the belt. but he won that year, 1970.
You know, if you go to Camden Yards now in Baltimore, you will be greeted by a huge number 5 that's outside of Camden Yards. That, of course, was Brooksy's number. And Brooks Robinson, and he hasn't played now for 43 years in Baltimore, he's still very much beloved in that city.
Yes, and still lives there. He stayed in Baltimore, but still loves Arkansas. He was back a couple of years ago when they renovated Lamar Porter Field. Was there for the dedication. I don't think his health is great right now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much he travels, but, again, he still considers himself an Arkansan. And, you know, his nickname, as you mentioned several times, was Brooksy.
Yeah.
But in this clip, some people referred to him as Arky.
I heard somebody a moment ago before we came over here refer to you as Arky. So obviously, even though you live in Maryland now, Arkansas is still very much a part of you, and I know you're proud to contribute to our state by representing us so well in Major League Baseball.
Well, thank you. I've always been happy to be associated with Little Rock and Arkansas. I tell you, the fellow who called me Arky was Joe Schultz, who's managing at Kansas City, and he was my second manager in professional baseball. And when I got there, I was 19 years old, and that's the name he pinned on me right off the bat was Arky, you know, so I still hear that a lot. But, I kind of have in the back of my mind that one of these days I might get back to Arkansas. I really like the pace of things there more so than living in the East, but it's much easier living in Baltimore and when you play there, you know. If I was playing someplace else, well, I might be living in Little Rock, but now that I've been in Baltimore for a long time and I haven't been traded, well, it's just much easier on your wife and family to stay in one place.
And if you want to hear more about him growing up in Arkansas, there's a book. Mm. I have it. It's an easy, good read, but it's called Third Base is My Home. Mm. And it's his autobiography.
You know, there's another, there are several people in the Baseball Hall of Fame that were born in Arkansas, Lou Brock, Dizzy Dean, and one that I don't think you'd be able to find anything on, and that's Arky Vaughn, who was born in Clifty and starred for the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 1920s. Probably don't have anything digitized with Arky Vaughn, do you?
I'll look for it.
Well, all right. Don't be disappointed, though. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. He visits with us almost every week with some of these great clips. And you can find these and much more if you Google Pryor Center and go through their website. Randy, if you'll have us, we'll let you come back and do another one.
Hey, if you'll have me, I'll be here.
It's a deal. Thanks, Randy.
KUAF is supported by The Momentary, now open with limited entry, timed tickets. This new contemporary art space in Bentonville features visual and performing arts, whether on-site or online. Ticket reservations and information on today's art and artists, curated music playlists, and more available at themomentary.org. KUAF is supported by Arcega's, offering social distancing-friendly locations on the corner of Church and Center Streets and the drive-thru on MLK Boulevard in Fayetteville. Menus and order ahead with curbside delivery available at cArcegasFastLane.com.
We are almost at the end of June, which means we're almost at the end of KUAF's fiscal year, and we'd like to thank you for allowing us to reach our end-of-year fundraising goal more than a week before June ended. Your support this month and for the past 35-plus years allows us to keep bringing you news from here and around the world every day of the year. Thank you.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Thanks to everyone who donated to this station in the last member drive. And if you know someone else who donated, thank them, because they're supporting this community. They are helping to make sure that we, as citizens, are well informed. Couldn't happen without your support. So thanks once again.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thursday night, Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC shared a letter from the president and CEO of Washington Regional Medical Systems. The letter had been sent to staff on June 19th. Then someone passed it on to Maddow. On June 19th, Arkansas reported 4,705 active cases of COVID-19. And on that day, between Washington and Benton counties, there were nearly 1,900 active infections. Maddow confirmed the letter's authenticity with Washington Regional. And then Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek requested a copy as well. She tells us more about what it says.
I got a copy of the letter from Washington Regional Medical Systems President and CEO Larry Shackelford on Friday after he had shared it with his staff the week before. He starts the letter off with this. Nearly every component of our health system saw a meaningful surge in COVID-19 related activity. Our two COVID-19 dedicated inpatient critical care units experienced a dramatic increase in both the number and acuity of patients, with census nearing 75% of capacity. Our screening centers saw a daily average of 320 patients, with staff being presented the additional challenge of having to conduct those screenings in full PPE in the heat of early summer. He also states that Washington Regional's supply chain became challenged as in-house rapid test kits were used up faster than the inventory could be replaced. Washington Regional's call center also set new records almost daily with more than 900 calls that week. And the positivity rate of those patients who received testing exceeded 14%. Shackelford also writes about his experience visiting Washington Regional's two COVID-19 units. Quote, I was not prepared for what I experienced. My first conversation was with a critical care nurse concerned for his family and their financial well-being. He was thankful to have a job. My next conversation was with two critical care nurses who shared the particular challenge of having to deliver news of a patient's death to loved ones, the language barrier and the strain in trying to communicate that the loved one was not simply asleep. A respiratory therapist shared her activity app results that stated by late afternoon she had already logged 28,000 steps. Hospitalists and intensivists commented that the care of a typical COVID-19 patient required three times the amount of time required for a normal critical care patient. Shackelford goes on to say he's extremely proud and encouraged by the staff he had met. Quote, while I try to reassure each of you and truly believe that we've got this, there is often in the pit of my stomach the fear of the unknown. How high is the hill we have yet to climb? He ends the letter by writing that he wept, but also became inspired. Shackelford then quotes Winston Churchill regarding the foolishness of trying to predict the future at the expense of focusing on the task at hand. That quote goes like this, "It's a mistake to try to look too far ahead. The chain of destiny can only be grasped one link at a time." For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzanna Sitek.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, a new report finds a disproportionate number of minority children are living in poverty in Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has that story, plus the militant grammarian, John Brummett, and more on Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
Welcome to 60 Second Civics from the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. When laws or governmental actions conflict with a citizen's views of what is right and wrong, the citizen faces a difficult decision. In our system of government, you have a right to try to have laws changed. There are many ways that you and others can work to change laws that you think are unjust. Until you get them changed, however, you are held responsible for obeying the laws. But suppose a law requires you to do something you believe is wrong. Must you obey the law? Some people argue that since no government is perfect, a citizen's responsibility to obey the law has limits. In their view, if a law is unjust, the citizen has no responsibility to obey it. However, deciding to disobey the law has consequences that the citizen must be prepared to accept. Such consequences might include paying fines and even going to jail. Throughout history, many citizens have accepted the consequences of disobeying the law. For example, during the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, Martin Luther King Jr., Fred Shuttlesworth, Rosa Parks, and many others chose to go to jail to protest racial segregation laws. Their sacrifices spurred legislation that eventually dismantled segregation. That's all for today's podcast, 60 Second Civics, where civic education only takes a minute.
The theme to 60 Second Civics, written and performed by Cheryl B. Englehart. You can find her online at cbemusic.com. The song featured there, Complacent, which you can find on Apple Music along with all of her music. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Alma. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Zuzanna Sitek and Jacqueline Froelich. Jacqueline, providing information about absentee balloting. Timothy Dennis mastered our show this evening. Our Monday appreciation to Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for his help. He'll be back with us a week from tonight as we'll focus on Faye Jones. Additional content for our noon show earlier today provided by KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock. We'll be back tomorrow at noon with a brand new Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for listening.